Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. International experts predict North Korea could develop a workable missile with a reliable warhead by early next year, one that could reach the middle of America. President Donald Trump tells the nation his administration will handle North Korea. The Pentagon tests an unarmed ballistic missile this morning, and Americans consider once again what it means to live in the shadow of nuclear weapons. It's a conundrum that dates to the moment the atom was split in 1939. The questions perhaps only increase in urgency and complexity. We begin the hour by welcoming author and Washington Post reporter Dan Zak. His book is called Almighty: Courage, Resistance, and Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age. It is now in paperback. Dan Zak joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Thank you, Lori.
I'm experiencing some existential peril myself this morning as we put all the pieces together. Tell me when this story in this book, you focus on the history of the development of the atomic bomb, but then very much on a story that came across your desk around 2012. Take us back to that moment where you first heard what had happened and how it developed into really a need to write a book.
Yeah, my awareness and interest in nuclear weapons before 2012 was scant, if non-existent. And it was an incident in East Tennessee at a nuclear weapons facility in 2012 that got me interested in this topic. In July 28, 2012, three peace activists, one of whom was a then 82-year-old Catholic nun, hiked a wooded ridge, cut through four fences, and intruded into a nuclear weapons facility in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, outside of Knoxville. They spray-painted biblical messages of peace on a building that stores our highly enriched uranium, sprinkled human blood on it, and then waited to be arrested. And it was the audacity of this intrusion, this very serious breach of security, and also the personal histories of these three activists, including Sister Megan Rice, that got me asking, well, why did these people do this? Why did they risk their lives and the lives of others? And then also, what is this site? What does this site do? And what are we doing with our nuclear weapons? And I used that story as a window into this larger topic of our nuclear arsenal.
It was so compelling that you needed to write a book about it. That hasn't happened to you before. What was it about the story that just wouldn't let go?
I think it was a combination of things. It was my own shame and not being more aware of the history around nuclear weapons and what we're doing with them now. But I was also kind of tantalized by how faith plays a role all across this issue. These three activists who committed these fairly serious crime of trespassing on government property. They were eventually charged with intending to endanger the national defense. They entered a lethal force zone in this facility where they could have been shot on site. I was fascinated by the faith that is required to take such an action. And then I discovered that there's also faith on the inside, on the other side of these fences, faith that nuclear weapons actually keep world peace, that nuclear weapons, by existing, make world war so unthinkable that there has not been a World War III. And I think that is a faith, too. Nuclear weapons themselves are a faith. And, of course, the faith that motivated these activists to break in is, I think, in many ways equally as powerful.
This theme appears right on the first page of the book. It is such a compelling read. It's hard to really understate that. It reads a little bit like a thriller as you go through. And we see these activists and their supporters really having the sacred preparation and the sacrament of human blood. And it's interesting. Did you hear their stories of that moment? How did you get that level of detail?
Yeah, so I obviously talked to the three activists who committed this act. And I interviewed the supporters who were with them the night before. And, you know, they don't do this. You might say that their actions are reckless, but mentally, emotionally, spiritually, there's a lot of preparation. There's a whole almost year-long process that they went through, not only to plan the actual intrusion, but to make sure they were doing it for the right reasons. You know, there's a lot of spiritual and religious energy that goes into this. And so they had a mass the night before they broke in. You know, they were asking themselves up until the last moment whether they were doing this for the right reason. Or, you know, they were asking, are we doing this just for, you know, personal acclaim or for ourselves at all? Are we doing this because we believe it's the right thing to do? And the three of them decided that was what they were meant to do. And so that kind of faith, that kind of spiritual preparation, they would say, is what gave them the strength and what gave them the success of their action, being able to get through these fences without detection, being able to get to the storage facility and label it with what they consider the truth, you know, putting human blood on the storage facility that they think represents the eventual murder of millions of people.
You mentioned, I think you were born in the early 1980s, 1983, and not really having a reference point for nuclear war, nuclear weapons, not something top of mind. The Cold War is sort of winding down at this point, certainly that you would have memory of. Do you find that to be fairly common among your generation, and is it time for a wake-up call?
I mean, I certainly think it's time for a wake-up call, but you could say that about any number of issues, I guess. Working on this book was certainly a wake-up call, and I wrote it for everyone, but I hope that people my age and younger, I'm 33, read it, because while the Cold War may have ended 25 years ago, and these weapons have receded from our imagination, they haven't gone away. You know, there are still nearly 15,000 nuclear warheads on the planet, 7,000 of which are ours, and 900 of which are deployed somewhere on the planet, either in the oceans on submarines or in the ground in North Dakota, just north of you guys. You know, 150 intercontinental ballistic missile silos up there that are on what they call prompt launch alert, locked and loaded, ready to go if need be. So there's a tremendous amount of both money and manpower that has gone into our nuclear arsenal and continues to go into our nuclear arsenal. And I kind of wrote the book to kind of remind us all that just because the duck and cover generation is long gone, the threat remains.
What sort of questions do you think people really need to ask themselves as they read the book about the current situation in America? How do we approach this topic? You mentioned faith on either side. How do we ask those kind of questions to get to the root of what we believe and what actions follow?
You know, I think a good strategy is to start with in a very practical way with the money element of it, because you know, even if you do not agree with activists who are committing crimes in what they see as the service of social justice, it's hard to argue that we're not being a little wasteful with what we're doing with nuclear weapons. And I think if people were to examine the amount of money that we are spending on them. We are embarking on a $1 trillion modernization of our warheads, and we are going to be building new submarines, new bombers. And there are plenty of experts out there who think that this is too costly and unnecessary. And so there are there's a practical angle to come at this through. And so if people were to look at the money aspect of it and ask questions of their elected officials, you know, that I think would have a certain degree of resonance.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment, my guest, author and Washington Post reporter Dan Zak. The book is called Almighty, and we're talking about courage, resistance, and existential peril in the nuclear age. And Dan, I'm wondering if we could go back to one of the great strengths of this book is the character development. It's nonfiction, but sort of the way we get to know these protesters, these activists, and others, some of the energy workers as well. Tell me about your relationship with Sister Megan and her origins for how she sort of began thinking about this issue that eventually would lead to her at the age of 82 taking such drastic action.
Sure. So Sister Megan, I mean, she's the reason why I was kind of superficially interested in this break-in in Tennessee. You know, I went to 12 years of Catholic school, and the type of nuns that I'm used to are rule-abiding and rule-enforcing. And then all of a sudden, I was hearing about this 82-year-old Catholic sister who, you know, committed a felony, you know, broke into a nuclear weapons facility. It's, you know, a serious breach of security. And so that was what initially got my attention superficially. I've interviewed her over years, and I interviewed grade school classmates and family members, and tried to kind of construct a personal history that explains why a woman like this in her kind of retirement years would choose to commit an action like this. And she was born in Manhattan during the Depression. She came of age in Morningside Heights right next to Columbia University during the Manhattan Project. So as the secret work on the atom was going on at the physics building a couple blocks away, she was experiencing that aura of secrecy among the adults in her life. Her parents, her next door neighbors were professors at Columbia. And she remembers as a young girl, everyone murmuring about the secret work going on at Columbia. And then, of course, when the news came out about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that was very impactful for her. And her uncle went over to Nagasaki after the bomb was dropped as an occupying force. And so he saw firsthand the devastation of nuclear war, and he came back a changed man. And that had also had a great impact on her, his niece. She goes off to Africa for 40 years and teaches over there, builds schools and operates them. Comes back and instead of kind of enjoying her twilight year, she decides to break into this weapons facility in East Tennessee. And I wanted to write about that connection between growing up in Manhattan in the Depression and during World War II and the through line to that and it being a motivator for her many decades after that.
Another interesting element of this is really the effect on the Marshall Islands and the Marshallese who live there. You went and visited the Marshall Islands. Put that in context for people who don't know the history about the United States testing nuclear weapons in the Marshall Islands and the legacy there today, both financially, as you mentioned, always pay attention to the money, and then personally on the citizens of the Marshall Islands.
Sure. The Marshall Islands are a small island nation in the Pacific, kind of equidistant between Japan, Hawaii, and Australia. They were occupied by the Japanese during World War II, but we seized control of them at the end of the war, and we decided that they were remote enough, far enough away from American soil, that they would be a suitable place for testing our most powerful atomic bombs. And from 1946 to 1958, that's where we did our large-scale testing, 67 different tests in the Marshall Islands. And to give people a sense of how powerful these detonations were, if you were to take the combined explosive power of those 67 tests in the Marshall Islands and spread them evenly over the 12 years we tested there, it would be equivalent to 1.6 Hiroshima bombs every day for 12 years. That's how powerful these bombs were. We moved some of the Marshallese around for these testings. The fallout from these bombs made some of the Marshallese sick. But we've always maintained a relationship with them even after we stopped testing in 1958. We've tried our best to clean up the mess there. We have granted them financial reparations, and we still have a financial and defense-related relationship with them today. We provide the bulk of their annual operating budget, even though they're an independent nation. And also, as we were all sleeping last night, we tested, it was our latest test of an unarmed intercontinental ballistic missile, which we fire off from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. And where does it land? Where did it land just this morning? It landed in the Marshall Islands. We still use them in part for our testing of our nuclear missiles. So the relationship persists today, and I included them in the book. I've traveled there, and I included the Marshall Islands in the book because they sued the United States a couple years ago, essentially making the same argument as these three activists, these American activists who broke into the weapons facility in Tennessee. Both the Marshall Islands and these activists are saying to the U.S., you are not compliant with international treaty. You're supposed to be eliminating these weapons. You signed a treaty in 1968. Saying you would pursue that, and it's not happening fast enough. And so I saw kind of a international analog or analogy to this domestic incident in Tennessee.
The Plowshares movement, this is the movement that supported the three activists and their actions in Tennessee in 2012. What are they up to now? Since 2012, have there been other major statements by them?
No. And the Plowshares movement is kind of this intrepid strain of activism that began in 1980 when a group of activists thought, why don't we, instead of looking at the Bible as kind of flat text, why don't we take some instruction and try and live out what's in the Bible? And so they looked at the book of Isaiah and the passage about beating swords into plowshares, spears into pruning hooks, transforming weapons of war into weapons of peace. And they said, well, let's live that. Let's actually break into these nuclear weapons facilities and begin that work symbolically and literally. And that's what happened first in 1980. And then has happened dozens of times since then. These activists swimming into submarine shipyards and climbing on top and hammering on the nose cones of missiles, and it's happened somewhat routinely. And the latest example of that was this incident in East Tennessee that my book is about in 2012. There has not been another Plowshares action like this since. But as I point out in the book, you know, this has been happening routinely since 1980. It's only a matter of time before it happens again, I think.
You would think in 2012, with the concern for international terrorism, that the actions would not have been successful. Was that part of the astonishment of this, is that it was even possible what they had done?
Yeah, that was exactly it. There were congressional hearings after this. I mean, this incident, this intrusion in 2012 was a huge embarrassment. Apart from being concerning, it was embarrassing. You know, this was supposed to be one of the most secure facilities on the planet. Three senior citizens can kind of walk in with relative ease and then wait to be arrested next to what may be the largest stockpile of fissile material on the planet. That's a problem. And once they finished what they were there to do, which is spray paint messages and sprinkle human blood, they waited to be arrested. They didn't try and cause mayhem. They didn't try and break into the actual building. And at these congressional hearings, congressmen stood up and asked, well, what if they had been terrorists? What if they had that uninterrupted access to this site and wanted to do some damage? Would that have been possible? Would that have happened? And I think that should concern everyone. You know, if human beings are involved, nothing is ever 100% in any endeavor in life. And are we okay with this margin of error when it is applied to some of the most dangerous material on the earth?
If you're just tuning in, the book is called Almighty. The author is Dan Zak. He's a Washington Post reporter as well. And Dan, I just want to ask you, what about this sort of freaked you out the most, or scared you the most, or alarmed you the most as you did the research and put the book together? What still stays with you and keeps you up at night?
Well, I think it's the relative inattention to it. You know, in Washington on Capitol Hill, it's an issue that is, I think, often given short shrift. There's kind of a lack of institutional knowledge in Congress about nuclear weapons at this point, now that we're 25 years after the Cold War. I mean, I think you'd ask experts, and they would say they are most worried about the prospect of nuclear terrorism. You know, and I don't want to overstate the probability because it's an unlikely event, but the consequences are certainly quite profound. I think another thing the experts would say they're worried about is some kind of regional conflict between India and Pakistan, both of which have nuclear weapons, and that kind of conflict turning into a nuclear conflict. There's any number of things that can go wrong. There's accidents, there's miscalculations all throughout history. You know, we've accidentally dropped thermonuclear warheads on North Carolina. They hit the ground and didn't go off, but it was an accident that could have been terrible. In 1979, we thought that there was a volley of Soviet nuclear missiles coming at us, and the National Security Advisor was about to telephone President Carter to say we need to launch our own and respond. But it was really a training scenario that had been loaded into the mainframe of Strategic Air Command, and it was just a dummy thing that we thought was real. These are just a couple of the very concerning near catastrophes and mistakes. And in some might argue that eventually one of these mistakes or incidents will actually result in some kind of detonation or accidental launch. So, I mean, that's what's concerning to me, is that even our most dedicated individuals, people, experts who are working in this, you know, nothing is ever 100%. And are we okay? And are we okay with that? Are we? Mm-hmm. Do we think that the security we think these weapons give us, is it worth the potential for accident or miscalculation?
Dan Zak, one more question. I feel I would be remiss not to ask you, what is it like to work at the Washington Post right now? Do you get any sleep whatsoever?
Well, there are certainly colleagues of mine who are covering politics in the White House who probably aren't sleeping, and all the credit goes to them. I mean, the pace and the volume of news and things that need to be covered this year seems to be quite substantial. You know, the newsroom here is very active. There's a lot to look into, a lot to cover, and it's a very active and disciplined place. But it is a marvel to watch my colleagues who have to cover this stuff. They are superhuman in that respect. So things are definitely busy around here.
We'll leave it there. Dan Zak is the author of the book Almighty: Courage, Resistance, and Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age. It's available August 1st. That's yesterday, in paperback. Go grab a copy and read up. Dan Zak, thank you so much for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Lori.